When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is sponsored by BT, because BT means business. BT knows that businesses come in many shapes, sizes, and guises, from the person just starting out at their kitchen table to the biggest employer, which is why no matter what line of work you're in, they've got your back to help you succeed and do what you do best. No doubt connectivity is a must in Westminster, and it certainly helped us to get this episode created and distributed to you listening right now. BT already connects more than 1 million businesses and public sector organisations, offering secure and reliable connectivity. Nearly three quarters of people running a business or side hustle feel they couldn't do so without reliable broadband and mobile connectivity. That's why having connectivity you can count on is a must for business, whether it be facilitating multiple devices being connected at once or making team calls or guest Wi-Fi access for customers. BT's connectivity helps keep you and your customers happy. Whatever your business, BT's got your back. Search BT's got your back.
Hello, this is the Red Box Podcast. I'm Matt Chorley, bringing you the best of my Times radio show, which you can listen to Monday to Thursday, 10 till 1. And I'd like to start by thanking everybody who has made this possible. I'd like to thank my agent. I don't have an agent. My wife. I do have a wife, incredibly. And everyone who believed in doing Politics Without the Boring Bits. Yes, amazingly, I've been nominated for my first radio award. Found out this morning, shortlisted for by the Broadcasting Press Guild. Ooh, as Audio Broadcaster of the Year. Although, it seems like it's more like everyone who's on the radio at 10 o'clock. Because I'm up against Clara Amfo from BBC Radio 1, who's on air at the same time as me. Frank Skinner, who's on Absolute at 10 o'clock on Saturdays. And Emma Barnett, who was on 5 Live at 10 a.m. But found it too much going up against me for 3 hours. So now just does 1 hour on something called Radio 4. No, me neither. Anyway, they're all legends and they know what they're doing. And now the judges are actually going to have to listen to my show. So there's no chance I will win. But it does mean that we can celebrate just being nominated, which is a good excuse to open a bottle or maybe two. But not until we finish the podcast, of course. Coming up, our big thing today is the culture war. Huh, what is it good for? Absolutely nobody knows. We've got some exclusive polling which reveals that far from gripping the country, only 4% of people even know what the culture war is. We'll find out what that all means for politics. But first, it's our columnist panel. It's a Thursday, so it must be Esther Webber and Robert Crampton. Let's kick off with... I'll tell you what, we've already talked a little bit about education already. Let's go straight to heading to the north. We were found out this week that Robert Jenrick is sending a load of his civil servants to Wolverhampton. And now Rishi Sunak has chosen a northern base for a new Treasury HQ. He's choosing between Newcastle and Leeds, apparently. They're the two main front runners. Is this a good idea, Esther? Or is it just sort of more possibly tokenism or whatever? Because ultimately, if all ministers are in Westminster... and every other government department is in Westminster, that's still going to be where the big machine is, isn't it?
Yeah, I think the problem is that unless you move the centre and the personnel of decision-making, then it ends up looking like a bit of a kind of superficial operation. But what I would say is I was talking to some people in the Department for Housing, or the Ministry for Housing, yes, it is now, and they were saying that actually the news about Wolverhampton has gone down pretty well because we're just working in a different way now, and maybe people are not so fussed about being in London and the idea of possibly moving somewhere new and having a different quality of life is a bit more appealing.
Maybe that's, you know, maybe you're right, Esther. Robert, what do you think? Is the experience of the last 12 months made us all realise that actually living somewhere a bit further away from London, you could probably have a bigger house, nicer quality of life. You could still do the same job and, you know, maybe go into London once a week, once a month.
Yeah, I think it's great news, actually. I think we're all a bit obsessed with London. And I don't think, I think it'll be received well in the north, either in Leeds or Newcastle, wherever it turns out to be. I don't think they'll regard it as tokenistic. I think they'll regard it as jobs, which is what is needed. Yeah, I mean, it's, the decision making is probably, obviously will stay in London, probably always will be in London, but a great many civil service jobs are, I mean, they're regular jobs. You can do them. You can do them wherever you are, and you can be a public servant in the north and have a very good quality of life, better than you can in the better than your quality of life in the southeast in terms of house prices and transport and all the rest of it. So I think it's good news.
And I suppose the key, the way that technology and a slight change in attitudes might actually make it work this time. Because I remember even during the last 12 months, I think Priti Patel in particular was very keen that officials were in the Home Office in person to brief and that sort of thing. It sort of defeats the point of home working. And it maybe they'll achieve something there. Because I remember writing about this about a year ago, I think, writing about this. I think Harold Macmillan had sort of kicked it off with the suggestion of moving civil servants out of London. And almost every Prime Minister since, Edward Heath, Margaret Thatcher, John Major, Tony Blair, you know, they all said we were going to do this. And actually what happened was the civil service in London most of the time just got bigger. But maybe technology and desire for a bigger garden might work this
way. And it has happened. I've said before, it's happened. You've got the passport office in Liverpool. You've got, DVLA in Swansea.
Yeah, that's true. Those distinct individual...
BBC went to Salford and everyone thought, the world would end and it's actually been fine, so... It's great.
It does sort of, that the BBC thing does make me sort of slightly laugh because the idea was they would get out of London and, they'd get a broader range of voices on the radio. And it turned out they could have just been using Zoom like the rest of us. It is possible to get voices of people across the country without building a big headquarters, and actually the obsession with getting people into studios. Who needs to be in a studio, he says, spare room at home. right, let's talk. Story just really tickled me today. Germany's biggest newspaper, Bild, has been praising the UK's incredible vaccine success with a front page headline saying, "Dear Brits, we envy you. Esther, two world wars, one World Cup, and now the vaccine race."
Well, I think that may shift relations like nothing else before. I think most of the things we talk about in terms of German-British relationships are in way in the past, and some people would say we're perhaps a bit too fixated on them. whereas this is very current and it's a real thing, and it's affecting people's lives. The fact that the provision and the rollout has really kind of fallen short of the mark in lots of European countries, and fair play to the Germans for pointing to examples of success which maybe they might have been more sceptical of before this all played out.
It is weird, the risk of continuing a footballing analogy, it does seem like it's a pandemic of two halves. This, Robert, the Germans, everyone wanted to be like Germany in the first half, and they were doing very well in terms of keeping the levels of cases down, but then seemed to be really struggling with the rollout of the vaccine.
Yeah, this is the equivalent of the 5-1 in Munich, isn't it? In 2001, was it? A hat trick from Michael Owen. It's good. I mean, a lot of it's been a real fashion for loving all things German, not least your contributor yesterday, John Kampfner, wrote his book about how we should all be more like Germany. And in many ways, obviously, John's completely correct. So it's quite nice to have that redressed slightly. I can't pretend that I'm not feeling slightly smug about this, although it's obviously I had absolutely nothing to do with it. It's good. and it's good of Bild to have exposed it. But President Macron was not very helpful with his remarks about AstraZeneca, and it's good that there's a counterweight to that.
Well, yeah, although interestingly, there's a poll in Germany which found that they've only delivered... that half the population would rather wait than receive the Oxford-AstraZeneca vaccine. That this sort of public suspicion, actually, like you said, fueled by political leaders... everyone here desperate. Yeah, get your sleeve up. Get whatever vaccine's going. Yeah. But across Europe, there does seem to be a real problem with people having their doubts about the Oxford vaccine.
Crazy. Sorry, I just think if you know some of our MPs have been saying some of the things that Macron had said, they've been sort of hauled in front of the whip and given a good talking to because. The spreading of some of the information that wasn't necessarily, shall we say, borne out by evidence does seem to have had an effect on people's attitude to certainly to the AstraZeneca vaccine.
The mayor of Berlin, has been very sensible. He said if you refuse the AstraZeneca, you have to go to the back of the queue.
That's good. I mean, I suppose the impact then politically is slightly different, isn't it? Because if the reason that people weren't getting their jabs was down to sort of bureaucratic incompetence, then maybe people might start getting cross with their political leaders across Europe. If it's because they don't want it, I mean, it's a different problem. And I saw some stats. I think it is still the case. The UK is now administered more doses than the whole of Europe put together.
Yeah,
the whole of the EU put together.
We vaccinated about 25% of the population. Germany and France are at about 4%.
Yeah, which is just extraordinary. But I just wonder how that plays out politically, Esther, in terms of if people aren't blaming their leaders because it's themselves to blame.
Yeah, I mean, I think there will be some sort of political reckoning, though, because in terms of what's happening here, like Boris Johnson didn't invent the vaccine. He didn't patent it or anything like that. But obviously the government has been, its approach is responsible for the delivery and the success. So they will reap some political dividends from that. And equally, if I were German or French, I'd be wanting to know why Macron had been handling this so badly.
Yeah, it does seem odd. And when there are pictures of Brits going absolutely wild on June the 12th, they've still got weeks or months of restrictions and waiting.
I bet French customs still won't let us in, though.
Well, we don't want to go there. We don't want to go there. Not with our British pubs.
We do if we've been vaccinated.
We're all looking for the looking forward to the end of lockdown, Robert. You've written your column this week in Saturday's Times about how you feel like you've got a bit, I don't know, eccentric.
Yeah, just feeling everything. I just sort of much more. I mean, I'm up and down kind of character anyway, but I've been much more up and much more down than usual. I was watching Death in Paradise the other day and I got really upset because I thought they were going to kill off one of my favourite characters. And I mean, I got properly upset and I just thought, this is Robert, you know, get a grip of yourself. And I don't want to joke about it because obviously there's been serious mental health issues going on, but I think even at a lower level than proper mental ill health, there's a kind of febrility, if that's a word, febrileness about all our behaviour, just going a bit strange.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Yeah, being strangely moved. But I mean, we watched the last episode of Call My Agent last night, and I felt myself getting unnecessarily emotional about a TV show existed like 3 weeks ago.
Exactly.
What about you, Esther? Have you felt yourself going a bit strange?
Yes, I very much recognise what you're both talking about. I think everything is very heightened in a weird way because actually so little is happening that like very small things going right or very small things going wrong can have like a huge impact more than they would normally. And I think I particularly feel it at the weekend when you sort of stop work and you think, now what? I definitely recognise that, and I think it's fine to sort of say we're all feeling it with it, even if it's not a really deep mental health problem.
Oof. Yeah, my mate Ollie's got this theory that part of what got us through last year was we had all these things in the diary, whether it's holidays or, you know, concerts or family get-togethers or whatever it was, and each one eventually got crossed off, but there was always the hope, well, maybe that thing in September might be okay, or maybe that thing in October might be okay. And the problem with this lockdown has been we've got nothing in the diary, nothing is planned, and actually now we can start filling up the diary a bit. You don't mind the fact you've got literally nothing to do this weekend, because you know in a few weeks time you might have something, including music festivals are back, Reading and Leeds. So we've been asking for COVID compliant bands and songs. Either of you got any ideas?
I got the wrong end of the stick with this. I thought it was it's not a pun anyway. One of my favorite bands, the Supremes, did a lovely song called Someday We'll Be Together. I think that would be nice.
Oh, that's good. That counts. Yeah. That's exactly the sort of thing that we want.
And Here Comes the Sun, Beatles.
Here Comes the Sun, that's very good. What about you, Esther?
It was just reminding me that I actually went to Reading when I was 16 and I saw Eminem and D12. They're the main acts I remember, but now I think it'd be Vitamin D12.
Esther Webb and Robert Crampton. Then, of course, you can read them both in The Times. Robert writes for Times 2 and for The Times magazine, and Esther writes The Times Red Box Morning Email. To read them both, you just need to get yourself a Times subscription. Go to thetimes.co.uk/Times Red Box. Up next, Culture War. Huh, what is it good for? Absolutely nobody knows.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
I'm Matt Trolley. This is the Red Box Podcast. Now it's time for this. Culture. Absolutely nobody knows. Yes, so the culture war. We hear a lot about it. You might read a lot about it, or maybe you don't. To the extent that everybody's talking about it, politicians and journalists anyway, what does the public make of it? Does anyone know even what it means? And what impact is it actually having on politics right now? Well, I'm joined now by Matt Smith from YouGov, the polling firm. He's carried out some exclusive polling into exactly this for us. Hi, Matt.
Hi there, Matt. Thanks for having me.
Now, normally we might get you to ask complicated questions of the public, you know, how they feel about different issues, who's up, who's down, and all of that sort of thing. This time round, you asked a very simple question. What did you ask, and what was the response?
Sure. So we asked very simply people to tell us what they think the culture war means. Now, if I just roll back a second to the last time I was on your show where we were discussing political ease and whether or not people had even heard and thought they understood some of these terms, we found that 31% of Britons, already a not exactly great number, said they thought they knew what the culture war meant. But now we've dug deeper into this and we've asked the public to tell us, to actually define for us what it means. And now we can see that only really about 4% actually gave us an answer that sort of looked remotely correct. When we asked, you know, them to define it, 76% just outright admitted, you know what, I don't know. And then another 22% gave something that's not really the right answer. So in fact, you know, simply put, nobody knows what a culture war is.
And so for the purposes of, just for clarity, the thing, I think this is right, the thing that we're calling the sort of the correct answer is that the culture war is a disagreement on preserving and viewing culture, history and national identity. That's the thing that, you know, that's to do with statues and yeah, all that exactly. Sort of stuff that plays into it. I mean, the fact that, 3% said a clash of ideologies, 2% said a clash between different classes, some sort of class war between, you know, the working class or the upper class, whatever it might be. So what does this tell us then about the sort of the national political conversation and the impact that that's having on, actual public opinion?
Sure. I mean, I guess it just goes to show what a misnomer calling it the national political conversation is, because what it really is the Westminster political conversation. It's a conversation being had between journalists and public affairs consultants and politicians way above the heads and interest levels of the entire public. It just goes to show ultimately how insignificant this kind of thing is for your average member of the public. And obviously it's a pretty good indication as well as to how important people might be expected to consider the various components of the culture war to be.
And what about on the specific issues? Do you do polling on things like statues or pronouns or flags or whatever, the specific issues which sometimes get wrapped up in this bubble of culture war?
Sure. And we do on bits and pieces. So I should just give a few caveats, of course, is that when you ask someone about a very specific thing, they will give you their opinion on it. But what it's not very good at sort of showing is, in the scheme of things, how important that is relative to other stuff. So, for instance, when we asked about pride in the British Empire, only one in five people said it's something that they think people should be more ashamed of than proud of. And then you've got a third of people think it's something more to be proud of than ashamed of. And then another third or so who are saying that, you know, it's something to be neither proud or ashamed of. But what that doesn't really show is, in the scheme of things, you know, how important that is relative to, you know, the big and obvious stuff like coronavirus and stuff like that. You know, when we run a tracker on what the most important issues are in the country to people, and at the moment, you know, you've got health on 60% and economy on 57%. And if you were ever to sort of, throw in one of these particular issues in, you know, you'd see that languishing on low single digits.
Yeah, I suppose that's the thing. Yeah, there's a difference between forcing someone to take a position on it when you ask the question, and it's quite difficult to capture to what extent do you give a monkey's about this as an issue. I suppose the thing that, because I'm writing about this for the Times this morning, I mean, like everything, it's just an import from America, and the culture in America divides along pretty straightforward partisan lines, Republican versus Democrat. In the UK, to the extent that it exists, it seems to cut across more on Leave versus Remain rather than Labour, Conservative, and then you have this sort of, loosely lazily generalised as older, northern, less well-educated, working-class, salt-of-the-earth types on one side, and then you've got sort of younger, posho university types who spend all their time just tweeting, you know, social awareness messages, which is totally simplistic and offensive to both camps. I accept that. Yeah. But the interesting thing with this was even looking at Leave Remain, 75% of Leavers didn't know what the culture war was compared to 72% of Remainers. And it was women, 80% of women, 83% of working class and retired voters also had no idea. So it's not as if this is particularly striking a chord with any particular group.
No. I mean, again, if I might say that the actual divide is therefore between real people and political people. You know, it's one of those classic things where it's something that can only be understood if you make politics your livelihood or your hobby, and obviously that doesn't apply to very many people at all, regardless of you know their partisan leanings. You know, there's nothing inherent in being a Conservative or being a Labour voter or being a Leave voter or being a Remain voter that makes you substantially more interested in politics. And then, of course, you know, even within the fact that even within the concept of being interested in politics, you know, getting down to the sort of real minutiae in which the sort of culture wars occupies rather than the sort of broader thrust of voting intention or sort of, you know, NHS funding or something like that.
As ever, a really useful corrective on the things that people in Westminster talk about compared to the rest of the country. Matt Smith from YouGov, really good to talk to you. So let's speak to one of those people, as Matt was describing, who makes his livelihood, and perhaps you could say hobby, out of politics. Stephen Swinford is the political editor of The Times. Hi, Steve.
Good morning, Matt.
So let's talk about this, and it's the extent that Downing Street sees that it's a warrior in the culture war, if you like. Is this something that, and it feels maybe it's slightly, it comes and goes in waves. We have sort of, you know, attacks on the BBC and you're trying to suggest that someone wants to take down every statue of Winston Churchill last year, and then it sort of goes out of fashion a bit. And then we've had another run recently, Robert Jenrick on statues, Gavin Williamson on what he's called strengthening free speech at universities, despite not a lot of evidence that there's an issue with free speech in universities. Oliver Dowden, you know, telling museums that they've got to keep their controversial objects. To what extent does Downing Street think that the culture war is a real thing?
So you've got a prime minister who, for a lot of his career, when he was a journalist and a commentator, made a kind of career out of writing polemics with really strong cultural war references in them, and that was something that he did a lot. But to be honest, now where Downing Street is, their focus is entirely on getting out of the coronavirus crisis. So I think, as your piece says today, Matt, there are kind of some cheap headlines to come out of initiatives such as the, you know, getting up debates on these things. But actually, it feels very, very odd, and it feels very surreal to read those stories, because we're in the midst of a pandemic and we're on the cusp of a recession. So that your piece today is particularly good. Your reference to the World War II Japanese soldiers still fighting in the jungle in the 1950s, because that's what it feels like. It feels like culture wars have kind of always been around, and they've always been around in Britain as part of the British media. But at this point in time, they feel particularly out of place and odd. And that is entirely what your column's about, Matt. And it does feel weird. It doesn't feel quite the time to be having kind of strange debates about different aspects of, or relatively small aspects of our culture and the way we look at it.
And it felt partly that this was born out of the success, if you like, of the Brexit debate in basically forcing almost every person in the, almost nobody in the country really had a position of saying, I don't really mind either way, to be honest. I mean, I basically got a bit fed up with it. But I mean, in terms of sort of galvanising people into camps, Brexit and Leave and Remain, that seems to be the sort of underpinning. Some of the most outspoken voices in still trying to wage the culture war are also outspoken voices in favour of Brexit. But it feels to me like they slightly missed the point that the 2019 election result was actually a vote to end Brexit, to stop forcing us all into taking hardline positions on something, and that people wanted to move on from that. But this sort of sense of trying to keep that grievance going and think, well, OK, so some people who voted for Brexit quite like Winston Churchill, why don't we make out that everyone's trying to take down a statue of Winston Churchill, even if that isn't really the case? The interesting thing, Steve, is that Keir Starmer so far hasn't really fallen into that trap. I mean, there was early on he faced some criticism for taking the knee and that sort of thing, and you know, the question of whether or not he was too woke or whatever. But actually, quite a lot of the time now, the government keeps laying these sort of culture war traps, which he just sort of gingerly steps around, doesn't fall into a row about statues or whatever. And so it ends up being with the government sort of slightly fighting this war on its own.
And it does look strange. It looks out of place, Matt. But one of the things I wanted to say was it's a new brand, culture war, but it's nothing new. So you and I, Matt, we came through the regional papers. I came through the Western Daily Press. I think I'm right in saying, Matt, you came through the Western Morning News. And routinely, the headlines in the Western Daily Press, which is a great paper, but it was often, there was fury across the West last night was the intro about whatever the latest, what would now be deemed a culture war, but then wasn't. It's nothing new that there are rows being fought. And also the territory for these rows changes. Another thing that we're both old enough to remember, Matt, is when, for example, let's take one issue, let's take green issues, environmental issues. The Prime Minister, former Prime Minister David Cameron, famously referred to it as green crap. And there was various kind of very heated campaigns against wind turbines on land, which dominated the Conservative debate and did so for some time. And now the debate's shifted and you can't, the Prime Minister is just embracing wind turbines left, right and centre, and it's all very green. So they are a product that they've always been part of political history and the political narrative. What we debate and what we talk about changes. It's just that when you're in the middle of pandemic, it feels very, very weird.
Yeah, and I suppose that's the thing. And also, maybe people are slightly more aware of cabinet ministers and that sort of thing. They've seen them in press conferences. And then when you suddenly, you know, 1 minute they've been announcing how many people have died, and then they're on the telly, and they're saying, what are you talking about? Why are you talking about statues? And it all just feels a bit weird. Steve, lovely to speak to you as ever, despite reminding us that we've both been doing this job for quite a long time now. Stephen Swinford there, the political editor of the Times. He used to work at the Western Daily Press, so their stories would start, there was fury across the West. And I used to work at the Western Morning News, and we would start our story. Is there was fury across the West Country, because that's how we slightly divvied up our respective areas.
Matt Chorley, mid-morning on Times Radio.
Culture. Absolutely nobody knows. Yeah, so we've got this polling from YouGov, exclusive polling for Times Radio, which found that only 4% of people could say what the culture war was correctly. 76% had no idea, and loads of other people went off in slightly strange directions. Let me know what you think about this. 87222, start your message with the word Times, or tweet me at Times Radio. I'm now joined by Dr. Matt Beach, who's the director of the Centre for British Politics at the University of Hull. Hi, Matt.
Good morning. Hi.
And Martha Gill, the comment editor of the Evening Standard. Hi, Martha.
Hiya.
So, Matt, put this into the historical context. Stephen Swinford, political editor, was just talking to us about this and saying it's nothing new. Maybe just the phrase culture war is the new label for it. You do a whole course on cultural conflicts. This isn't anything new, is it?
It's not new. There's always been cultural conflicts in the United Kingdom, in complex societies. But I would say that the cultural conflicts that we're witnessing now, the effects of them, you know, really start post-war, and they start really when with what we would call the new left. And I think the important thing just to say is that broadly speaking, it's quite easy to say, well, look, you know, people don't understand things when you poll them; they're very esoteric. If you go away and poll how many people understand what the Northern Irish Protocol is, or what does humanitarian interventionism mean, I reckon you get low numbers. But if you polled people and you said, you know, have you ever had to self-censor? Or what do you think of women's only spaces? Or should there be certain books that students don't read at universities? I think ordinary members of the public, not just the Westminster bubble, do have real views about this.
Do you think that actually, if you said to what extent are you concerned about this, you might get a slightly different. I suppose the thing, if you push someone into taking a position because they feel like, well, if somebody's asked me, I ought to know something about this. Is it maybe just not that high in people's minds?
When it's an esoteric general stuff like culture war, yeah. I think something a bit. But if you get down right to the nitty gritty and say, should statues be torn down by mobs, or should they be removed and put in museums by local authorities? You know, should feminist academics and female politicians be disinvited from universities because they have a different view? Should certain books be removed? Should we decolonize curriculums? You know, people have very strong views about things like that. So I don't really accept. And I also think there's probably a bit of a space to try and say, let's depoliticize all this stuff. Let's I completely take the point that we're in a pandemic and we've got to keep the main thing. Absolutely. But at the same time, I think it's quite legitimate for members of the opposition benches and members on the government benches to talk about history, literature, statues, pronouns, women-only spaces, BLM. And for me, when I try and raise these things with my students, I say, what we've got to try and do in an open and free society is find a way to civilly disagree and live together in a peaceable way. And for that to happen, first of all, you've got to be allowed to have as pretty much as generous free exchange of ideas as possible. And secondly, you have to understand that a lot of these disagreements come in the post-war, and they're generally speaking between people who are broadly in the Western liberal tradition, that might be social democrats, that might be conservatives, that might be classical liberals, and people who are broadly influenced by the new left and by different forms of Marxism. And we have different values. And you can see that through our political history from the 1950s onwards, when you think of, those folks who came out of the Communist Party in reaction to what the Soviet Union was doing, and the new left, the extra parliamentary activity, the student protests. And so this is a story that I think historians of Britain and sociologists are very well versed in. But it actually does come down to brass tacks. When you have massive protests, you say, OK, what are these protests about? What do people want? Okay, issues of speech, statues, people being invited, women's only spaces, the whole debate about feminism and transgenderism. These are real things. And it's fine to say, oh, golly gosh, we're in a pandemic. Let's focus on getting the jabs in people's arms, which is a great thing. Let's invest in the NHS and all this other stuff. It's just frippery. Well, to be honest, I think there's a space in the media that actually, is actually quite useful to try and depoliticize political issues. And because if you depoliticize them, you almost say there shouldn't be any kind of criticism or counter voice to really legitimate things. I mean, I wouldn't want to be some of the academics that are worried about their jobs because they've, posted certain things on a blog or written certain. I mean, I wouldn't want to be that person. I think, I think there are legitimate concerns, and I absolutely don't think that there's no fuss about free speeches in universities. And I think it's quite right that the government's taking this seriously.
OK, let's bring in Martha Gill there. It's really interesting point that Matt was just making. I suppose, is the issue that individually these are important issues that we could be discussing, but wrapping them up, if it's sort of the intent, is it because you actually want to sort out and find the correct balance on free speech in universities? Or is it because you're trying to fire up one base, one on one side or the other, in order to sort of keep the war going, if you like, rather than, reaching a amicable peace?
Yeah, I feel like bringing it up in this way is not necessarily going to calm everyone down and have everyone discussing it in a sort of peaceable way, which gets to a conclusion. If you're very much, I feel like it is probably the latter, Matt, that they're trying to perpetuate this culture war because they feel it's going to help them. My feeling is on that is that it's not going to help them, because post-Brexit, it's all going to be about, for the Tories, trying to unite disparate groups of Tory voters, only some of whom will agree with them about statues. And in fact, the rest will be repelled by this particular stance. And as you say, some of it is only cutting through at the moment on the sort of metropolitan elite level, people on Twitter, people who read about politics and live in cities, some of whom are Tory voters. And these are precisely the wrong people for that message to currently get through. I mean, my feeling is there is a really good angle for the Tories to take on this that would help them, which is, and also a very important important one, which is the sort of capricious firing of employees by institutions and companies when they get on the wrong side of the Twitter mob, or yes, indeed, the deplatforming of academics, etc. And that's sort of a real problem for Labour and the left, because these are precisely the people they should be trying to protect, employees' rights. But they don't really want to touch it because they are also, their voters are sort of more on the woker side of the argument. So, in fact, the Tories could be really really confronting Labour over that and trying to make them take a stance, but that's not what they're doing. They're banging on about statues, which I don't think is going to necessarily help.
Is the issue also, Martha, that it sort of it becomes really extreme, that you're either on one side or the other, and if you're not completely signed up to, you know, all of the views of one side of the campaign, then you must be a dreadful person who's on the other side of the campaign. So if you say, you know, statues don't offend me, I totally understand they might offend other people. So that's outrageous. You either want to chain yourself to one to preserve it, or you want to tear it down. And actually, you know, sometimes the same is a bit the same with, you know, Black Lives Matter. It's an incredibly political campaign.
Exactly.
And if you don't sign up to all of it, then you're a racist. That's the, you know, that sort of extremism, which, you know, extremism in politics is never a good thing.
Matt, you've completely hit the nail on the head. I think the reason we've all come to some kind of consensus on climate change is because no one's really talking about it, because no one's really making it into a culture war. If the Tories were like, right, we think this on, if there was a full and, you know, thorough debate, cultural debate about climate change and whether or not, you know, people on lower income should be made to buy a expensive boiler, etc., you know, or not, I think we would have made much less progress on it, and we'd be sort of stuck in a stasis where nothing would get done, etc. And so I think making something into a national discussion is not necessarily a way to advance the argument. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, that's really interesting. It's really interesting. Matt Beach, has the issues that you cover in your course, are they changing? Is it difficult for you? I mean, this feels like, from an academic's point of view, a bit of a, as you were saying, you know, the trouble that other academics have got into. Is this a bit of a minefield for you to try and teach and discuss?
For example, this year I've added BLM onto the syllabus because one can't ignore it. The BLM movement has been around for a while, since sort of like 2012-13, but it's come onto my course. I have to put it on my course simply because, and I teach at University of Hull and in a very fine department of politics, but precisely because it's not just the chattering classes in Westminster that are talking about this, and not just young people are interested about it, but, you know, it is something in our culture that matters. And so in that sense, yes, there are some things that I think are, you know, that have been on my course for a couple of years. My course is quite new, and it's the most popular, most signed up course in the final year in our department. But it is a controversial course. But the issues of free speech, the issues of what should a university be for, you know, should universities have one kind of goal? Should their goal be like a conception of trying to find truth, scientific truth, or, you know, should it be about social justice? To what extent, you know, is there a tension between feminist thinkers and feminist theories and transgender thinkers? You know, a whole range of, you know, intersectionality. These things stay on the course because they are in our culture. And I think if we link it back to Brexit, all I would say is this. Brexit, I think, is more about culture than economics, absolutely. I don't think Brexit naturally fits in the kind of the story that I was trying to explain about post-war and the new left and sort of different forms of liberalism and Marxism. I don't think Brexit really fits into that. I think Brexit's an older story politically about, you know, who are the British and who do the British want to be? It does come down to things of sovereignty and borders and monies and law. So for me, even though I write a lot about Brexit, I say I don't think it sits in the story directly that we're talking about. It's kind of an offshoot to some extent, but I think really, if you look back to the history of when we joined on the 1st of January 1973, for much of the year or 18 months before that, there was huge debates about sovereignty and independence and where was Britain's role in the world. So I think it's a cultural debate about Brexit. Absolutely. It has cut across left, right. Absolutely. But I wouldn't say it's in the same kind of group of culture war issues in terms of speech, the role of the university, books, council culture and all that kind of stuff.
Well, we've come to the end of this episode of the Red Box Podcast. Don't forget to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts from. Listen to my Times Radio show every Monday to Thursday, 10 till 1. You can listen on DAB Radio, on your smart speaker. Get the Times Radio app. You can also listen to the Red Box Podcast of the Times Radio app as well. And if you want to read about the stories that we've been talking about, then you need a Times subscription. To get that, go to times.radio/subscribe.
Hold up. Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal, to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.